Bob Slayton is a New Yorker. He's from the Bronx originally. He went to the Bronx High School of Science. He then has now migrated west, not just west of the Hudson, but actually all the way to California, where he is associate professor at Chapman College and chair of the history department there. Bob Slayton was, as I said, trained here in the East. His first academic degree comes from SUNY Buffalo. He then went on to Northwestern University in Chicago, where he got both an MA and PhD. And in Chicago, Bob drifted away from his New York roots. There is no doubt about it. His first book, Back of the Yards, is just this wonderful classic history of the neighborhoods created by Chicago's booming stockyards and slaughterhouse industries. And then he went on to focus more on urban planning and urban history, especially focusing on welfare, single occupancy, single room occupancy hotels and Skid Row, the development of, you know, basically low class housing in America. And more recently, in fact, for the last, over the last decade? 11 years, Bob Slayton has been working on a biography of a politician who rose out of the urban slums, Alfred E. Smith, New York's dynamic three-term governor in the 20s and the 1928 presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, the first Catholic to run for the presidency. Today he is going to give a variation on the theme on Al Smith. He is going to talk as is on the integral relationship of the sources in constructing a biography. So join me in welcoming Robert Slayton to our stage.
Before I start talking about Al, I'd like to thank all of you for being here at this ghastly hour to hear somebody speak. And I'd like to thank the Department of History and the graduate students and the city of Albany for inviting me here. When I first moved to California, I was petrified that everybody would look like Pamela Anderson or Keanu Reeves, and I most assuredly do not fit that profile. So I really can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be back in my home state at springtime. Albany is for me a very wonderful place. You are blessed with great universities and great historical archives. I spent a lot of time doing this book in the Cultural Center, time that really was very rich, both because of the collections and the people who worked there. So my thank you is not only to the organizers of this who brought me here, but to the people of Albany. You've always been a very wonderful host, and I thank you for that. Al Smith was a tough subject to write about, not because he was an unpleasant fellow. I loved Al, and I sort of miss him. But he was a tough subject to write about because he is so hard to track down. He's not much of a letter writer, other than official correspondence, and you don't have the kind of record you have for other figures. When you do Harry Truman, for example, there's this wonderful set of circumstances that Bess Truman just really hated Washington. So she always left there to go to independence as much as possible. And Harry could be sort of obnoxious and petty at times. I'm not that big a worshiper of St. Harry the One. And he would write these endless wonderful letters that were really whiny sort of letters going, Bess, you know what they were doing in the Senate? You know, they were picking on me and all this stuff. And you've got this incredible record of what was happening in Washington. FDR, his mother doted on him. She is clearly in the hereafter. I'm not going to try and speculate in which part. But wherever she is, it is clear that her greatest regret is that she lived in an age before there were refrigerator magnets. So she was not able to put every goddamn little thing that Franklin Roosevelt ever did up on the fridge. But she kept it all. And you don't have any of that with Al. So the way I found that you had to do this was you had to throw the net very widely. I looked through every collection of any politician, any person who was prominent in the 20s, who might have known Smith, who might have commented on the 1928 election. I just went as far afield as I possibly could. At the Library of Congress, I don't know, I looked at between 40 or 50 collections. I started out when I did Back of the Yards doing oral history. And I really think if you're going to do any community study, you start with the church. I went to the cathedral here in Albany. I went to his church down on the east side of Manhattan, found old parishioners there. I think a lot of it, you have to walk. I believe in that very, very strongly. One of the things I did, for example, was I walked, I picked a place where Al lived. And I walked from there. I said, what did he see of his beloved Brooklyn Bridge? And I walked on a beeline, the quickest route he would have taken to the waterfront. And it was a very important moment for me because it leads you to a spot about 100 yards north of the Brooklyn Bridge. And you have this unbelievable view of it arching over the river. And you start to see the New York that he saw. And you start to understand why he loved it so much. Among the other things I did was that he lived in a very fabled neighborhood, but most biographers of him didn't realize that and didn't write that much about his neighborhood other than very superficial, oh, it's a wonderful immigrant neighborhood. So to find out more about that, partially I looked at all the people who were writing that it wasn't such a wonderful neighborhood and had a lot more insight, but I also looked for autobiographies of anybody who grew up there, and there were actually quite a few. Jimmy Durante had a lot of things to say about Al Smith and his mother, actually. In his autobiography, the most valuable of all people was Eddie Cantor grew up there. And to show you the kinds of gems you get if you throw the net widely, when Al runs for the legislature the first time, his first political outing is 1903. He's a total nonentity. There's no record of it. The Times is just, you know, in this ward, in this assembly district, this is who won. But Eddie Cantor, in his autobiography, remembered that first race. There's no other record of this. This is the first time it got published in an Al Smith autobiography, rather. And Eddie Cantor has this really wonderful story. He says that in that first race, the way Al would campaign is, he would round up all the local boys and he'd bring them to a bar. And the decision on whether or not they got a beer or a sarsaparilla was based on this really, he didn't have a complicated format, he didn't have to card them. If they were long pants, they got a beer. If they had short pants, they got a sarsaparilla. And he just lined them up at the bars going, beer, beer, sarsaparilla, sarsaparilla, beer, beer, sarsaparilla. And that's the first time that it was there. And sometimes it just led to adventures. As I said, I had a lot of fun doing this book. And I just want to tell you two stories. I, through a real roundabout chain of events, I contacted a man, an Englishman no less, who was the information director of the Fulton Fish Market. And I said, he offered to give me a tour, which I thought was wonderful. And Al worked in the Fulton Fish Market, as you'll see in a second. And he said, okay, meet me on this corner under the streetlight at 4 in the morning. Now, I grew up in New York, and you don't stand on streetlights and street corners down by the docks at 4 a.m. So I'm sitting there pondering, my God, should I take a lot of money in case I get mugged and I want to hop in a cab? Or should I take a little bit of money in case I get mugged, period, and they don't get as much? You know, these are New York calculations. And then I realized that, hey, if the guy's asking me to meet there, that's probably when it's operating. And sure enough, I got down there at 4 a.m. I took a cab down, and it was just bustling. It was just bustling. I almost got run over by a forklift truck. And it was very helpful. One of the things I learned from that was that Al had always talked about it as that he knew hard industrial work. And while the work was hard, it was very skilled, and there was a clear sense of community. And as I was trying to get a handle on that, we were talking to one of the fishmongers, and I said, boy, you know, people seem to know each other down here. Is that really accurate? And this is a true story. And the guy looked out. This is like a scene from The Sopranos. And the guy looked out in one of these impossibly deep and gravelly voice. And he looked out over the river. And I swear to God, he just looked out and he said, nobody forgives or forgets. And I didn't ask. I didn't want to know. But the quote went in the book. The quote's in the book. And sometimes this really took me far afield. In 1996, by then I had done the major collections where you can go and sit for months, Albany, Library of Congress, Hyde Park, and I had a lot of little collections where I would spend anywhere from a day to an hour in, but they were like in 22 states. So I got my little Honda, which I was driving back then, and that summer I drove 11,000 miles in 2 months. I went from Southern California up to Connecticut and back. And one of the first places I had to go to was Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is University of Arkansas. Al's running mate was Joe Robinson, who was from Arkansas, and his papers are there. And what happened was that, you have to realize, first of all, is that Fayetteville, Arkansas, University of Arkansas, is on top of this really bad hill or mountain or something. It's like a one-lane winding road going up there with the huge trucks with the pieces of lumber, I mean, like the tree trunks on it. It's like a scene out of Walking Tall Part 9, and I'm in my little Honda on this winding road, and it's really bad and dangerous. I mean, at that time, there's a sign there at the top of the hill when you're about to go down that says, please drive safely, 3 people have died here in the last 2 years, and you remember the little shrines by the roadside, and I'm going, I don't want to do this. And the reason I had to do it was because one of the biggest industries in Arkansas, of course, is Walmart, and Sam Walton sold shares to all his neighbors, and that, just by sheer bad luck, I had picked a time when the annual convention of Walmart was being held on the University of Arkansas campus, so you couldn't get a goddamn hotel room in Fayetteville. So I'm down at Fort Smith, which is the base of this. I'm leaving very early. I'm going, I don't want to ever drive this again in my life. So I get up there, and it's an absolute zoo. I mean, this is the Walmart convention. The faculty hated this, by the way. I mean, they had the Wienermobile was there, okay, and the Pepsi hot air balloon. It wasn't a very scholarly atmosphere. So the only good thing is you could park anywhere you want, because it was chaos. So I parked the car, I noted what building at least it was near, and I go looking for the library, because I want to get done. And you're winding around and about, I've got like a 30-pound bag with my laptop with all my stuff, and I get there, I work like a bat out of hell, and I finish up. It's now 5 o'clock, I'm hot, I'm tired, it's Arkansas in June, and I am totally lost. And I got to find my damn car. And I see a building, and on the side of the building, it says faculty support. And I said to myself, screw it, I'm faculty, I need support. So I go in. Actually, I didn't say screw it, but this is a family gathering. So I walk in, and there are 2 women there, one sitting behind a desk, and the other standing up. And I asked her to explain, I'm visiting faculty from Chapman University and blah, 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 and I need help and I'm near this building. And they start to give me directions, and it really is convoluted. I'm going to take out a pad. And the lady standing up says, the woman standing up, she says, how do you like a lift? And I was grateful. I mean, I had no idea where I was or anything like that. And I just, thank you. So we start to walk out, and we're walking towards her car. And she turns around, and she says to me, I hope you don't mind being kissed a lot. This is a true story. She said, my wife knows about this. This is legal. She turns around, she says, I hope you don't mind being kissed a lot. Now, the mind is a really funny thing, and I have absolutely no idea where this came from. I really do not. But almost instantaneously, I turn around, and I looked at her, and I said, babies are dogs, and she said, 2 big hound dogs in the back, hope you don't mind, they're just really friendly, okay? So we got in the car with the 2 big hound dogs, and she's driving me back to my car, and she asked what I'm doing, and I said, you know, I'm doing Smith, and are you from New York? Yes. And here I am in the middle of, you know, Billy Bob Thornton country, and it turns out she's from Brooklyn. So I'm in the middle of Fayetteville, Arkansas, doing, where you from? Avenue D. Well, my aunt's from Avenue U. Yeah, I'm up by Flatbush, the quintessential New York stuff. So you really sort of go far afield when you do research. And after all that, what did I find? Who was this guy? Al Smith. Al was a quintessential product of New York, but because of the age he lived in, I think that meant very much of America as well. He is born in 1873 on the east side of Lower Manhattan, down by the docks, near where South Street Seaport is today. He watched the Brooklyn Bridge get built from the front windows of his tenement. His heritage made him part of the new America. It was bursting forth in American cities. He was of immigrant descent. Well, Al Smith was always considered an Irishman. His story is actually more complex, but I think that makes it a lot more American than that. On his father's side, thus, his grandparents came from Italy and Germany. It was his mother's people that was solidly Irish from Westmeath County, and his father died young, so it is his mother's identity that he adopts so completely. He is somewhat undistinguished as a child, pleasant enough. He goes to Catholic schools, though not for very long. His father's early death meant that Al had to drop out in seventh grade. To put it as bluntly as possible, whatever he achieves later on in life, he had never received a grade school diploma. Instead, he goes to work, toiling again in a number of city jobs, fairly undistinguished, as I mentioned before, the most famous of which is in the Fulton Fish Market. He also picks up an important hobby, and that is he loves the theater. He stars in local productions, the kinds of really bad melodramas put on in church basements in the 1880s. But it becomes very critical training for a politician. First of all, as you'll see in a moment or two, he learns how to deliver a good line. He learns timing. He also develops the actor's facility for picking up lines quickly. One of the amazing things about the Al Smith records is when you look for his speeches, some of them are clearly, particularly if they were sent as a press release or typed out and very neat and nice, but Al's, the actual way he would prepare for a speech is he would take a bunch of number 9 envelopes, standard legal size is number 10, it's a little bit smaller. He always would then work with a really thick nib pencil. And he'd take the first of the number 9 envelopes and he'd write a series of numbers on it, you know, 1 through 6 or something. And then he would take 6 envelopes, mark them 1 through 6, on the first one rather, he would write the key points of his speech they wanted to talk about. He'd number the other envelopes 1 through 6 and he'd put a bunch of newspaper clippings in them. And that was it. That's his speeches in the files. He learned this from being an actor. He could just go out and command the stage because he was that good and had that good a command, of course, of New York State. And that was his speech writing method. An outgoing lad, he wanders naturally into politics, and of course that means Tammany Hall. He has a number of small jobs, and as I said, in 1903, he goes to the Assembly. At first, things don't go that well. In 1903, the New York State Assembly was a very patrician body. It was run by upstate lawyers, upstate farmers, and by tradition. Al Smith was an uneducated hack, and even worse, he was a Tammany hack, and thus he was expected to stand when he was told and to vote as he was told and not expect a lot much more. And he puts up with this for a couple of years. He thinks about quitting, and he decides to stay. And this is the turning point in his life. He decides not just to stay, but to excel. He makes the most important decision he ever will. He shows his true colors. He says, if I'm going to be in the Assembly, I am going to have to succeed whatever personal shortcomings he may have. He now sits down and proceeds through incredibly hard work and some native smarts as well to literally master the legislative process. Al Smith, with a seventh grade education, reads every bill that comes before him, and I mean every one. No one, and I mean no one does that, except a couple of the clerks. If he doesn't know what a word means, he looks it up. If a bill is an amendment to section 654-3-C of the Civic Code, he looks that up too. And if 654-3-C is a rider to 925-1-M, he reads that as well. If he has to, he stays up till 2 or 3 in the morning going through the law books. He goes through everything, even the mammoth appropriation bill, which no one ever reads, for crying out loud. No one except Al Smith. Now the pieces come together. He develops a speaking style that combines this incredible knowledge with the wit and timing of his earlier training. He can command the legislative floor with this vast body of data, but can use humor to keep a debate going. Two stories. First, this is Al's favorite story. This is the one he repeated over and over. He's debating on the floor of the Assembly against a bunch of Republicans, and another Republican, Gottfried Wend of Buffalo, comes running in with big news. He's got to interrupt. Mr. Speaker, I have to interrupt. Big news. What's the big news? Just heard. Cornell won the big boat race. Well, the first guy, Republican, turns around and says, doesn't mean anything to me. I'm Yale. Second guy says, me neither. I'm Harvard. Third guy says, I'm a U of M man. Al turns around and says, doesn't mean anything to me either. I'm an FFM man. And he'll go, gee, Al, we don't know. What school is that? And he turns around and goes, Fulton Fish Market. Now can we get on with the debate? Now that was his favorite. This is my favorite. He's championing the first workman's compensation bill in New York State history. And he's talking about it on the floor when a rival member from across the aisle, Jay Pratt of Oneida County, asked to pose a question. The speaker agrees, and Pratt was not a very nice man. And he turns around to Al and says, "Mr. Tammany leader?" See, to Jay Pratt, this was one of his little bag of tricks. If you were a Democrat, you were automatically from Tammany, you were automatically a Tammany leader. This is rotten stuff. He turns around and goes, "Mr. Tammany leader, what good is the Workmen's Compensation Act to the 350,000 men out of work in this state?" Now, this is nasty business, because this is a real red herring designed to distract. Whatever the pros or cons of workmen's compensation, it has no effect, and it's got nothing to do with the unemployed. You have to be working to get workmen's compensation. According to all accounts, Al turns around without breaking sweat, just instantaneously, he turns around and he says the following. "Mr. Speaker, I was walking down Park Row one night, and a man came up, hit me on the shoulder, and he said, 'Hello, Al, which would you rather be? Hammock full of white doorknobs, cellar full of stepladders, or a piece of dry ice?' I said, 'I'd rather be a fish, because no matter how thick plate glass is, you can always break it with a hammer.'" Pratt jumps to his feet. The indications are he was angry. It would have been a goddamn miracle if he had not been thoroughly confused. And he says, I don't get the point of the gentleman's remark." And Al calmly looked at him and said, "There's just as much point to my answer as there was to your question. Can we get on with business?" And that was the end of that. By the time he steps down in 1915, Al had been both minority and majority leader, as well as being elected Speaker of the Assembly. But I think the best example of what he had accomplished is that in 1915, New York held a constitutional convention to revise the state's basic body of law. It was presided over by the most elite of the patricians. The chair was Elihu Root, graduate of Harvard Law, former Secretary of State, former Secretary of War, winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1912. There was George Wickersham, who had been Attorney General of the United States under William Howard Taft. Very, very Republican gentlemen. And who captivated them? I'll give you three guesses. Neither Root nor Wickersham made it a habit to compliment Democrats, let alone those who came from Tammany Hall, but Root publicly stated, "Of all the men in the convention, Al Smith was the best informed on the business of New York State." George Wickersham called Al the most useful man in the convention and told reporters he was sorry that Al didn't have a law degree because he really wanted to hire him for his firm. Before I move on, I just want to talk about one other situation. And in part, I do this as a way of saying what a fascinating guy Al was to research and write about.